Community.
Vibrant people.
A representation of our expanded strength.
Identity crisis.
And inability to be exterminated.
Legacy.
Roots that are established way beyond geographical placement.
Recognizing our combined struggle.
Migrating community.
Bridging gaps.
History. And
I don't know.
Welcome, this is Diaspora Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse. I'm your host, Awa, and today I'm here with Fouad Boussoir.
Hello, hello, hello.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi guys, my name's Fouad. I am many things, but for today I am a poet. I used to call myself the Reluctant Love Poet, so I think it's quite appropriate to be on here today.
Do you consider yourself as part of a diaspora?
Absolutely. I was born in Lagos. I lived there till I was 10 years old before moving here in the middle of winter. Moving from Lagos to London in December, it's not for the week. But yeah, like I often find myself thinking about home and where home is as I navigate my identity.
Would you say you consider yourself as part of a diasporic community in London? Or is that not really something you relate to?
I'm just like always in loads of different spaces. And I'm often in loads of different spaces with other black people, right? Typically black people from the continent of Africa. However, I don't feel like our identity as members of the diaspora is as spoken as it is lived. Do you know what I mean? Like a lot of like the art and things that we create do reference our identity as members of the diaspora, but it's not necessarily something that we kind of like speak on and hold. Do you know what I mean? So like, I feel like it's difficult to be like, I'm part of a diaspora community, because I guess that's not the name on the door. You know what I mean? But it's what we kind of like communicate with each other.
So how does diaspora take shape for you?
Yeah, like I said, like it's in my art. I have a lot of work around home, around my, as I mentioned, I'm from Nigeria, which is a very, very, very interesting place. I actually watched a movie a couple of days ago called My Father's Shadow, which, if you guys haven't watched it, it's amazing. But it kind of like explores the story of two young boys living in their father's shadow, because something happens to their father, which I will not, you know, no spoilers, but it's set in Lagos, and they have the whole movie is literally like a whole day trip around Lagos, and like I found myself like remembering and missing so many aspects of it, aspects that cannot be recreated authentically where I live now. But I also live in Woolwich, which, if any of you are from London, it's known for Nigerians. And so like I can't walk down, you know, the high street without seeing, you know, plantain and people speaking my language and things like that. So it's all around me, both in my art and in my lived experience.
What's your language?
Yoruba. Yeah.
You introduce yourself as a love poet.
Yeah.
What has your first encounter with love been?
Oof. That's a good question. I think I have a poem. It's called The Heart, because my name, Fouad, means the heart. But I've had such a very interesting relationship with love. And I would say my first true encounter with love is of my siblings. I'm the oldest of four, and I have like a 10-year age gap, a 13-year age gap, and a 24-year age gap with my siblings. And having, you know, lived to watch them grow and learn and see how I can help shape the way they see the world in a positive manner has been, I would say, my first real exercise in love, because the one after me came when I was 10 years old at the time. So that's what I was kind of like, you know, finding consciousness and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I would say for my little brothers and sister.
So how would you define that love?
I just want so much for them, you know. Not necessarily like, oh, like they need to be billionaires and CEOs and all that kind of stuff. Like I want them to experience life in any way they choose. And I want to be someone who can create the building blocks for them to achieve that. Me being someone who can facilitate and help that happen fills me with joy. And I work very, very hard to make sure that I can make that happen.
In like how you explained it, it seemed like it's a lot of intention and like putting in effort. Yeah, just having wishes for people and having like this strong willingness for them to be good. So how would you define love independently now from your siblings?
Yeah, I think obviously love of my siblings is a very specific component on love. But I think love is central to everything. Every single thing that we do as human beings. like, for example, right, you think about, you know, a lot of people, like, when they love someone, obviously that's typical love, but if I really like my iPad, I think it's the greatest, the best one I've ever bought. I love the iPad. Even in spaces where you don't think love exists, like if you're sitting on a long journey on a plane and you feel uncomfortable, like, and you hate being on that plane, yes, but you love the comfort that doesn't exist in that space. And I truly believe that, like, everything that we do is an expression of love or lack of it. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, that's how I would define love. It's central to our being. And there is nothing, I truly believe there is nothing that we do that doesn't have love in it. But how do you define love?
That's a very interesting take. I have a follow-up question before I respond. Would you then understand love as, like, an essence or, like, a feeling more than anything else?
I think love drives our feelings. It's the thing beneath that allows you to feel love and anger and sadness and joy and elation. It's the baseline of our humanity. And obviously, like, you know, you can talk about, like, animals and that kind of stuff, but I think it's bigger than the feeling. It's the thing that drives the feelings and gives us something with which to decide how we feel about different spaces.
What is this base made of? Because when you talk about a base, like, mm-hmm. the base of our emotions, right, the thing that drives us, it doesn't say much about what it is. It only says something about what it does, right?
You're right. I think it's difficult to quantify, like, your essence, which is why, like, I find it easier to look at how it drives the things that we do. I don't think I have the language to fully quantify the essence of it. But, like, if you were to ask me, like, you know, what is love, which you have, I'd be like, why are you doing this podcast?
Why do you think that has anything to say about, like, love? Because that's a very specific question. Mm-hmm. What drives me mm-hmm. in this very specific endeavor?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't say much about the rest of my life or the other things that I'm doing, right?
The reason why I use that as an example is because I think when you dig deep, like, when you get to the bottom of it, it's because you love something. And I think for most people, when you dig down beneath what they do, you find love.
So do you think love is purpose?
Yes. Amongst other things, yes, I think love is purpose. Like, I think, like, you can ask me, like, any single individual thing, and I believe that beneath that thing is love.
I remember in an earlier conversation, you told me about love as what feels like home, love as space. How would you incorporate that in your definition, in what you just explained?
Yeah, so space, right? I love my room. Like, I love my room. I love the space that my room kind of presents. I love being able to just know that there is somewhere that I can go home to. Like, the love is intrinsic in that definition. Like, it's the building block of it, you know? It's like...
Is it though? Is it the space?
What else could it be?
Or is it your relationship to the space? Because you can feel at home in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have had that room, but you could have also had another room.
Mm.
So is it the relationship you build up with that thing, with that person, or that space?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it really the space in and of itself?
Mm. I think there is no distinction. So I'm doing a module in uni called Open Political Ideas, and there's this guy who's doing his essay on this idea of dualism. My understanding of it is, like, dualists believe that there is a separation between subject and object. Do you know what I mean? There is a separation between the person who does and the thing that is done. Based on that definition, I consider myself a non-dualist because I don't believe that there is a true separation between subject and object. I think you asked me, is it the space or is it my relationship to the space? The space exists because of my relationship to it. The space exists because I put paintings up. The space exists because I bought a specific kind of bed and I bought sheets that I like. The space is intrinsic to what I've created. And in that process, my relationship is created to it because I'm like, oh, like, I remember this picture. And, you know, could it be another room? I'm literally moving house right now and I'm going to be setting up another room, and I'm going to love that room as well because I'm going to spend that much time and effort into it. But all of that is love. There is no distinction between the two things. And if I was to then walk into a random room that I didn't build and I don't have a relationship with, I wouldn't love it as much. But yeah, like, I think it's the two things are so interwoven, in my opinion.
That's really interesting. I think that actually gestures towards what I would understand as love.
Mm.
You said it's the effort you put in that room, how you decorated, the amount of care you put in, like, setting up the space and making it feel like home, right? To me, this is exactly what love is about, is how much intention you have towards, obviously, like, the thing, the space, the person, but also the amount of care you're going to put in it, how much you're going to respect the space, how much you're going to respect the person, how well you will know the place or the person or the thing, and how much responsibility you take towards or on that space or that person. And this is actually something bell hooks talks about. Bell hooks differentiates between cathexis, which is more of an emotion and a feeling, and love, which is an action. And so when you start thinking of love as an action, and she says love as the will to nurture your own and another's spiritual growth, that's when you start seeing all the side things that can take shape in different ways, depending on whether it's a person, whether it's a space, whether it's an object. But it eventually comes back to whether you have intention, whether you put in care, whether you put in respect, knowledge, and responsibility. And I would also add accountability. And I'll get back to that in a second. But essentially, bell hooks talks about how understanding love as action also prevents us from being in relationships where we experience abuse and still try and call it love. Because if love is the action and not just the emotion, you couldn't say, I love you, but I don't care about you. I love you, but I don't take responsibility towards you. I love you, but I don't really know you, right? And I think that's why I'm also incorporating accountability into this definition. It kind of draws back to responsibility. To me, accountability is this thing where, like, you're not going to do everything right. Sometimes you, for example, in, like, relationships, you will hurt someone. But taking accountability is, like, taking the step back, realizing your actions and wanting to kind of do something about it, and, like, really having the intention and putting in the effort to kind of, like, correct, apologizing, or just, like, kind of wanting to spiritually grow, right? To me, it's like this realizing that we will never be 100% and never be perfect and never do everything right, but wanting to grow spiritually and in the context of the relationship.
Yeah, I like that. Like, love tries. I think it is important. When you say you love someone or something, or you're in love with someone or something, it's like, yeah, how are you showing up and showing that love? I think it's really important. I'd say I definitely agree with that.
So would you say it matches your understanding of love?
Yes and no. I think it fits within my understanding of love in the sense that, like, I think, you know, if you say you love someone, you should make the effort to, you know, call them regularly or whatever. But I don't know if I would agree that you not taking the time to call them means you don't love them. I think it means you're loving them imperfectly. I think it means you're loving them in a way that is unfair to them and unfair to yourself, and you're not respecting that the love that you have for them, and like that base feeling, and you need to do better, you need to take more accountability. But I wouldn't say that you not doing those things negates or means that you don't love them.
Well, I think there's many different things that come into play. I feel like, first, I don't think we can just say that love is this one thing that expands, like, with all its rules, and that it's applicable to everyone. So, for example, I don't think everyone wants and needs to be called to feel loved and to experience love with you. So I think depending on, like, how that person relates to other people generally and how that person conducts their relationships, they might not necessarily need you to call them regularly.
Yeah.
Now, if this is something that they need, something that they want, something that they're looking forward in a relationship, I think in that context, it would be a matter of, do you actually want to grow with that person? And I think here we need to understand how we set boundaries and how we want to relate to one another, because how that other person wants to relate to you is not necessarily how you want to relate to them. So it's like, do you agree on what kind of relationship you have, the extent of effort you're putting in one another, the extent of love that you're wanting to pour into one another, right? And I think when that is dysregulated, when it's unbalanced, then yeah, I think there's such thing as maybe someone loving you more than you're loving them, just because the amount of intention you're putting into one another is not the same. It's unbalanced.
Yeah, I agree. I think what you're describing is where everyone should be. If you say you love someone, that's where everyone should be striving to get to. Like, you should be striving to a point where you have balance and you have a love that truly fulfills both parties exponentially. But I think life, you know, like, life is just, it's difficult and people are imperfect. And I think love is inherently imperfect because as human beings, we're imperfect. You think love is perfect?
I don't think love is perfect, but I think we have a different definition of love being imperfect. I think that's why I added accountability and why I think responsibility in love is so important, because I ultimately think intention is not enough. And that's why I think it's important to me to differentiate between the emotion and the action, because the action might not follow up on the emotion. And you might have the emotion and set the intention, but not follow through with your actions. And then to me, it's not love. And it's okay that it's not love, but I think sometimes we have to come to terms with the fact that we don't necessarily love in places where we would want to love, or we don't love to the extent that we would want to love, or we don't love to the extent that the other person would want us to love, you know?
So if people don't match their intention with actions, like for other people, they don't love that person?
I think if there's a commitment to that other person and then you don't follow through with the actions, yeah, I don't think you're loving. Now, if you do have intentions, but these intentions are just not equivalent to what the other person wants from you, then I don't think it's necessarily not love. I think it's just an alignment. I think it's just you're not loving them to the extent that they want to be loved, and that's fair. And I think we just have to come to terms with the fact that it happens. It happens quite often. And you just have to find people that match your energy, you know, and that match your needs. And I do think that, like, you wanting to do it and putting in the effort, it's not going to be perfect. It will never be perfect. But I think it's a matter of how much you're willing and actively putting in effort to reach that goal.
I think the conversation that we're having at the moment is very along the lines of romantic love. I want to ask, when it comes to familial love, like, that is, I think it's a realm of love where I think a lot of the time the intention is there. Like, I think most mothers love their children, but I don't necessarily think most mothers do the things, especially when the child is old enough to quote-unquote care for themselves. Like, I don't think they necessarily do the things that match that child's conception of, like, this person is intentionally caring and loving for me. But I wouldn't say that doesn't mean they don't love them. What do you think?
What I said, I thought of it in terms of relationships generally. Mm. So that includes, like, familial relationships, but also friendships outside of romantic relationships. And then what you said is actually, like, something bell hooks talks about in the book All About Love that I quoted earlier as well. Bell hooks actually emphasizes that the context of the family is one of the contexts where it's most difficult for us to realize and come to terms with the fact that there might not be as much love as we think there is, because we can't come to terms with the fact that love is an action and not a feeling. So I do think that a lot of our parents want to love us, but they don't love us. They affect us.
I think it also really depends on, like, your definition of care. Like, if I'm a kid growing up, right? And like my father, I never see him because he's always at work, because he has to work to like put food on the table and put clothes on our backs. But I never see him, and I feel like he doesn't love me because, you know, he, like, I don't know that man. But he spends most of his waking hours caring in a different way compared to my conceptualization. Would that be cathartic, or would that be love in your kind of like lens?
In the example you've given, that father puts in a lot of effort to care for them, like financially, offer them like financial stability, food, shelter, all of the things that like we need to survive, right? Now, what comes into play here is like the child's feelings, right? Maybe they want their dad to be a bit more present. Maybe they want to establish a relationship. And the dad might not have the means to do that, right? The time, as you said. I think you're hearing the other person out and trying to adjust as much as you can is what caring and knowing someone looks like. The dad might not be able to take like 3 days off a week to spend time with their children, but they can hear them out on what the child needs and how they can adjust their lifestyle or way of communicating, really, to kind of make the space, make the relationship feel more comfortable, you know? And I think in the context of the diaspora, this happens very often, right? We've got very busy parents and we don't really have the opportunity to build up that relationship. And I think the generational gap is also much more present when we have not been raised in the same country, in the same like socio-political context, right? So I think in these contexts it's really difficult for us to actually naturally meet our respective needs. But I think that's why we need to communicate, and I think communicating is what facilitates the rest, essentially. Like, you have to learn to love somebody, I think. And I think the only way to do that, especially in the context of relationships with your parents, is to communicate your needs and for them to communicate their needs as well. Because I think this is something that we tend to forget, that they also have needs and that they're not just parents, they're also humans. And sometimes we just have to find compromises.
Can you love someone that you've never met?
I don't think so. To me, that comes back to the point on knowledge. I think you can't love anybody you don't know. Do you mean like physically met?
No.
Tell me a bit more about your question.
Okay, cool. All right, so my father, right? My father was never in my life. And I grew up never meeting him. I mean, he met me, but I never met him. I was too young to remember. But I grew up having this feeling of there's this person, this human being out there, and I have so much within me that I feel for them, but I don't know them, and I've never met them. And I believe that upon meeting him, like if I ever did, which I can't, but if I did ever meet him, like I think all of those feelings would pour out and erupt, because all of those feelings have been within me. There is no action to take, you know, to make it love, according to Hooks. But to me, that love is intrinsic in my being. That's half of my DNA. That's half of who I am, at least on the biological level. And to me, that deeply, deeply drives my level of feeling towards that person. But I never met him. I didn't know him.
But I think that, again, is the difference between the feeling and the action. I do think you can have feelings towards someone that you have never met. And I think we often have very strong feelings towards people we haven't met. The typical example in romantic relationships is when we say we fell for potential. I do think that we build up images of people. And I think in the context of your family, in the context of your dad, yes, I do think that you build up this image of that person in your head, and that triggers a lot of feelings, especially when you're biologically related to that person. But I think that's cathexis. I think that's exactly what cathexis is about. I don't think that's what love is about, though.
That's fair.
Do you think love is political? Do you think that it belongs to the public sphere?
I think love I think love is everything. I think it's both public and private. And if we look at the most dramatic examples of political and public love, let's look at Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. He was talking about the love of his children and the world that his children could grow up in. But it's a deeply political thing for so many people, and it's had such a great impact on so many people. So I think you can't look at that and say what he's saying isn't political, because it's directly incongruous with the nature of society at the time and, you know, the relationships between black and white people. But I also think you can't look at it and say that it's not love. Like, he spells out for you, like, I'm building this for my children and I'm building this for my daughters. And so I think love is definitely both... it's political and apolitical when it wants to be, and it's both public and private.
I think you have a perfect example of that in your personal life, which is the organization for Black Boys.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, for Black Boys is my baby. So you're right, it's an organization I set up a couple of years ago, and the idea is to create space, to create community, to create belonging for every kind of black man. It's a big thing, but in practice so far, it has meant throwing events for, at the moment, young men at university age, from things from like chess tournaments to DJ classes to teaching guys how to cut their own hair, how to cook, to watching football together, taking people to see plays. Yeah, it's been one of my acts of love. And I know you're going to ask me, you know, like, what drove me to set up for Black Boys? And I said it at the beginning. I said it because, especially my little brothers, I love them so much and I want to change the world for them. And I want to build a world where they can grow at their own pace and not feel like they have to be anything that they don't want to be. They can create life how they want to. And for Black Boys is one of my conceptions of that. You know, I want to change the world for black men everywhere. And as a result, my little brothers get to benefit from that, as do hopefully many, many, many young black men across the flipping world. But yeah.
How would you define love in the context of four black boys?
It's the care that I'm taking to build this space and the effort and, you know, the action, as you say, to do this thing so intentionally and so intently on like a personal level. And that's been a 2-year-long journey so far. And I believe it's going to be a lifelong journey. I want to do this for as long as I live. So I am showing love every single day by spending so much time and effort to build this space for black men. But on a general level, I guess we are providing the things that these young men may not have had the pleasure of experiencing as they've grown up. You know, we have an event called the Barbershop, which I mentioned earlier, which is the whole idea is that we get student barbers to teach guys how to cut hair, how to shave, how to maintain themselves on a physical level. I was never taught that when I was growing up, but we are turning around and giving it to these young men who may not have had that. So yeah, like the things that we do are intrinsically about love, you know, about enriching their lives. And I think, yeah, love is deeply, deeply kind of like woven into that process.
Why is it particularly important for black boys?
I think it's important for all men. And I get asked all the time, like, you know, why is it just black men? And the answer to that question about why not all men and why there's black men is because my lens through which I see the world is through the lens of a black man. That is a lens and that is the context which I understand. So that is the context which I would create from. We are taught so many things about ourselves by the world around us. And you grow up and you realize at some point, if you have that presence of mind and of self, you realize at some point that you are this caricature of a person and you carry yourself in that image. And I want to challenge these young men to see more for themselves, to see that, okay, cool, like, is this what I really want? You know, is this what I really want to be? And to give them the luxury to choose, you know, rather than, you know, realize that you're just a caricature of a person.
And I think this is a big part of the project of black feminism, right? Emphasizing how emotion is structural, it's historical, it's political. I was reading about this concept of affective politics that I was not too familiar with. It essentially refers to how emotions and feelings affect political lives and how our emotions and feelings are affected by political life as well. It really resonates with what you said about four black boys, that these emotions, these feelings are public, they're not private. And I think especially in the context of Black people generally, there's kind of these stereotypes are like forced onto us, and then we don't really know to differentiate between like what we are and what we have been told we were. That's why I think these spaces are so important. And I think there's definitely patriarchal oppression within the Black community, for sure. But I think white feminism led us to dismiss the oppression that was very specific to Black boys, very specific to Black men. And so I think that's why I feel like this emphasis on love politics that's part of Black feminism is just so important to stress and to advocate for, because these love politics are the spaces we build to heal and to learn to relate to one another in a healthier capacity, and in a capacity that allows us to learn to be ourselves and create ourselves as well, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've done a lot of, like, in my education, I've done a lot of, like, study of Black masculinity and just Blackness in general. And I remember I did an essay which was about knife crime. It was when, like, knife crime in London was crazy. Like, there was, like a month where London had more murders than New York. And I just thought that was a crazy stat, right? And I did an essay exploring the effects of, like, poverty and social exclusion on, like, people who then go on to commit crimes and be victims of crime. And I end up speaking to a police officer. I spoke to a member of the London Assembly, which are like people that like advise and like critique the work of the mayor. And I spoke to a charity worker as well. And it was really interesting. As I'm kind of like going essentially up the food chain in terms of like interactions with these people, so the charity worker being at the bottom, people who actually day-to-day interact with young men who have been both victims and perpetrators of crime, all the way up onto the London Assembly member who's like, they see stats and they see numbers, like the way they interact with these very political issues, you know, poverty, social exclusion as a result of, you know, your mother or your father or your parents have moved to this country at a certain age and they have to make something for themselves, so they're working every day, right? And then like I talk about in one of my poems, like, and then like you see your family struggling and you're like, oh, you know, like I see these guys in the park and like, you know, like they attempt to hold something and like I make more money than I know that my mom earns in a week, and you're like, oh my gosh, like I have a way to help my mom, to care for her, to love my mom. And then before you know it, you kind of get pushed up and up and up this pyramid to the point where you're at a very young age where you're doing crazy things and you're like, who am I and what is going on? And when you speak to the people in power about this, their answer to solve this problem is more policing, it's force. And like a lot of the work that I do is like, it's ultimately trying to help people to understand that we are dealing with human beings, we're dealing with boys, right? Boys who at a very young age are doing something that is deeply related to, you know, like, I want my mother to be happy. I don't want to be a burden on her this week, right? So I'm going to do this one thing, which I'm a child, I believe this thing is innocent, whatever, and I don't have the context of the bigger structure that I'm entering. And yeah, like, before you know it, like, you're doing crazy stuff, and I want to humanize these people and educate them, which is not to be like, oh, you know, give a pass to guys who do crazy stuff. It's like, okay, can we get in there early and help this young man understand, like, you know, you did this thing now and 7 years from now, this is what your life will look like, and changing their futures in that way as well. I think it's important.
What do you think of the concept of Black love?
When I think about Black love, I think about American movies and TV shows, literally. Like, I think about, you know, things like Love and Basketball, and like there's a movie that I love, it's called If Beale Street Could Talk. If you guys haven't watched that movie, watch that movie. It's the most beautiful conception of Black love and how political it is, and you know, how it can be drawn across racial lines. And yeah, like I think you'd be hard pressed to watch a movie or TV show or read a book about Black love where, you know, the issue of politics isn't front and center, and how, you know, as human beings, we can't simply exist and love each other and just be normal, you know. It all affects us. But it's interesting, though. I haven't had as much of a strong conception of Black love from a British lens. Yeah, I just don't think, you know, it's as strong over here.
Okay. I don't know. I think I've seen it a lot on social media, like this debate whether is problematic because I've engaged with these debates so much and I've spoken about it a lot with my friends. I felt like some people would not get how important that is. And I think I've always kind of seen it as like another manifestation of love politics generally.
Mm.
In the sense that to me, black love has always been this thing where like you kind of claim things that you've been told were not good. Maybe it's also my relationship to Senegal and being a mixed child, in the sense that I feel like there was this discourse back then, at least, that like it was a good thing that my dad married a white woman, and that it was kind of like stepping up the social hierarchy.
Mm.
And I've always been very frustrated with that, because to me it was like, no, but like it's cooler for me to be Senegalese than it is to be German. Actually, I don't want people to dismiss that part of my identity, because I think like the automatic thing people would be proud of or excited for in regards to me was me being German and me speaking German. And I was like, no, I actually want to speak Wolof. I want to be fluent in Wolof. I want to go back to Senegal. I don't really want to go back to Germany. And it's always been this thing that like I was trying to counter that other narrative that was like, it's good to have like a white side in quotation marks. And I think to me, black love has always been that, like kind of being like, well, no, we actually like our culture. No, we actually like our people. And no, we're not going to hate each other within our community just because it serves your interests.
I completely agree. I completely agree. I think black love is super important. And especially, like you said, like when people express non-black love as something that is better, it's like, what does that mean? So yeah, I completely agree with your conception of that.
Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for coming in, Farad.
No problem.
If you have any questions, if you have any comments or thoughts on the discussion we've had, please let us know. This was The Aspirant Diaries, a podcast powered by Transmission Roundhouse.